You're listening to
Sex Gets Real.
Sex Gets Real.
Sex Gets Real.
Sex Gets Real.
With Dawn Sarah.
With Dawn Sarah.
Thanks. Bye.
Hey everyone, Dawn Sarah here with Sex Gets Real. I have my first listener confession for January that I'm going to read in just a minute. It is from a listener who's going by CK, and it's on our January theme of firsts. If you want to submit your first story, which you can either record and send to me or type out, and I will either read or have read, you can go to sexgetsreal.com/EP143 for episode 143. There's a link with all of the guidelines. January's theme is firsts. Doesn't have to be your traditional first. It can be any kind of first relating to self, love, sex, relationships. I also announced February's theme in the newsletter that went out last week. So if you aren't already on the Sex Gets Real newsletter list, be sure to hop over there where I will be doing advanced sneak peeks and sharing the theme for each month for confessions. So I hope to hear from you soon. This week's episode also features an interview with Sarah Pappalardo, who is the co-founder and editor of Reductress, which is a comedy satire site that uses satire to really highlight the way that mainstream media and kind of mainstream feminism influence us. And she's also the author of a satire book called How to Win at Feminism, The Definitive Guide to Having It All and Then Some. And this episode is actually something I'm really excited about. You know, I know that I talk a lot on the show about media literacy and the importance of us being able to suss out the difference between mainstream media feeding us content and, of course, needing us to click over and over again. And so, of course, the sensationalist headlines and the stories that they tell that inform us, and really being able to look within for our own answers, even if it seems to kind of fly in the face of what all of the messages around us say. This conversation with Sarah is both serious and funny. You'll hear us laughing about a Reductress article that they had about how to be gracious meeting your boyfriend's mother for the first time when you're filled with his cum. And they did this fantastic homepage takeover that was nothing but articles about rape culture, but it was actually like really funny and accessible in such a powerful way. And so Sarah and I are going to talk all about that. We also laugh and make some jokes that are very like steeped in misandry. And we also kind of point out some of the contradictions around feminist men who come into spaces and try to take up space, the ways that we create cultural feminist icons in people who maybe weren't really ready for that. Amy Schumer comes up when we talk about that. And even though this topic or this interview isn't specifically about sex, it is very much about the way that the media and the way we consume it influence how we think about sex, and the ways that these really ridiculous articles get created from scientific studies that just sent so many of us into tailspins of shame and pain. And so I'm really excited about this. But before I dive into my chat with Sarah, I want to share with you this listener confession from CK. She offered a content note that it does include emotional and mental abuse and abuse within BDSM. So if you're sensitive to that, then you might want to just skip ahead a couple of minutes. Here we go. I've been more or less constantly in a relationship since I was 14 years old, but I didn't leave someone until I was 24. He was older, much older. We met when I was 19, and he was an accomplished academic in his mid-30s. I was submissive. He was not so much dominant as domineering. The power disparity between us was built in from the beginning and only increased the longer we were together. It was ostensibly a polyamorous relationship. He was married. By the time we'd been together a couple of years, though, it was apparent that his version of polyamory involved him being able to do whatever, whenever, and with whomever he wanted, while I was kept on an increasingly tight leash until I was effectively ordered to be monogamous to him. The list of abusive behaviors I was subjected to ranged from screaming at me, to vicious attacks on my character, to punching things in front of me and making it clear he'd be punching me if he was less nice. And into all of this, 5 years later, just as I'd accepted this was pretty much my lot and was about to move in with him and his wife as his collared slave, another man entered. A longtime friend, our conversations started out innocently enough, and neither of us saw it coming when we fell in love. I'm talking the kind of love that hits you with the force of an 18-wheeler truck. We were lost. We couldn't keep away from each other. Night after night, we talked online and fell harder and harder. I begged my master to allow the relationship to open up again on my side. Remember, he was allowed to do whatever he wanted, and I wasn't allowed to say anything about it. But it was useless. He made me promise I'd choose him, and then, of course, he tried to make me choose between the two men I loved. My new love went to see him and try and reason with him. By this time, my new love and I even offered to take sex off the table. All we wanted to be able to do was hold each other and kiss. My master ordered us to stay away from each other. We managed 2 days. That week, my master alternately ignored me, yelled at me, and sent me vicious text messages. The biggest professional challenge of my life came on that Friday night, and it passed without my master even acknowledging it, despite knowing how important it was to me. The next morning, I went to see him. We talked for 4 hours. I told him he was abusing me and it had to change. He told me his behavior was fixed and nothing would ever change. He laid out his terms for the privilege of continuing to be in a relationship with him, terms that would render me even more powerless than I already was, if that was possible. I told him no. I gave him back his collar. He tried to cajole me into staying. We'll go to counseling, he promised. But by then, it was far too little, far too late. Again, I told him no, and I walked out of his house. I called my new love. It's over, I said. Come and see me. He drove the 100 miles that separated us. That night, I cried in his arms and then invited him into my bed. And the happy ending? That man is the love of my life. We're now living together and making non-monogamy work in a functional and equitable way that works for us. And that, at the age of 24, was the first time I left someone. CK. Thank you so much for sharing that story with us, CK. I'm so happy that you have your happy ending and that you were able to move through that very terrible, abusive, tough first. I think many of us can relate to that first, and I'm really happy to have shared it on the show. All right, everyone, if you're ready for this week's chat all about media and satire and me and Sarah just dripping with misandry, then here we go. Me and Sarah Pappalardo from The Reductress. Welcome to the show, Sarah. I'm so excited to have you here to talk about Reductress.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah. So for our listeners who aren't familiar with Reductress, what's your kind of highlight version of what people can find there and what it is?
Reductress is a satirical women's magazine. So we like to say it's like The Onion meets Cosmo, plus a whole bunch of other stuff that parodies women's media in general.
I want to just begin by saying that I hope every single person listening goes and checks it out because it's, in my opinion, guaranteed to both make you laugh and make you feel like, oh, thank God, I'm not the only one that feels that way.
That is the goal.
Yes. Yeah. So I have so many questions for you about what it's like creating the content and kind of your process and some of the amazing things that you've done over the years with Reductress and, of course, your new book. I know that you've got your new book, How to Win at Feminism, The Definitive Guide to Having It All and Then Some! Exclamation point. So can you tell us a little bit about the book and kind of some of the themes in the book? Because when I was reading some of the items in the book, I was filled with glee.
Oh, good. Glee is good. So the inspiration for the book came a couple years back when feminism was hitting the mainstream in a way that was both reductive, frustrating, funny to us. It just seemed like the media, the mainstream media, had kind of like adopted feminism without really knowing where it came from or why it was there. So we wanted to write a manual on how to be a feminist from the point of view of this like kind of clueless, well-meaning women's magazine who just discovered feminism. So a lot of the book is very much in the voice of Reductress, but goes deeper into like how to do love and sex as a feminist, how to like be in the workplace as a feminist, and most of the advice is pretty misguided.
As we see with most media that's specifically aimed at women.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And in that, we hope that, you know, you find a lot of nuggets of truth in that book as well.
Yeah. One of the things that I love that I saw as a snippet from the book, and I can't wait to read it, is how to be sex positive even when you're bloated.
Mm-hmm.
And how to love your body even though hers is better. To me, that just those types of things just encapsulate so much of what we see in like women's magazines and online stories and bloggers who are really into like the self-care spheres.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, do you feel like this brand of feminism that we see that's really highlighted by women's magazines right now is kind of the epitome of white feminism? Or do you feel like it's more about like merchandising and feminism?
I think the two kind of rely on each other. So I would kind of say the answer is both. Mm-hmm. I mean, on the one hand, you know, magazines, all media makes money through advertising right now. And, you know, we are then advertising to a demographic that can spend money. That is a consumer market, which means that we're inevitably excluding many, many women from participating in this exchange. So those people of means tend to be white or at least have a degree of economic privilege that a lot of women don't. So mm-hmm. Is it going to be a truly intersectional feminism? Maybe not. Not always, at least, unless there's a particular awareness of it.
Of course, because this show is about sex and relationships, and a lot of what I'm trying to do is very like countercultural and anti-patriarchy and that kind of stuff. And so I particularly love a lot of your sex and relationship headlines. I would love to know, like, what do you think is some of the most frustrating content that you see when it comes to talking about sex and relationships that's aimed at women?
To me, it's that everything is treated like all directives are this like monolith that we must abide by. And it, you know, we saw that in iterations in like old print Cosmo ads of just like 18,000 ways to have sex with your man. And that was, and just by nature of being the media, its voice is authoritative. And suddenly like a helpful sex tip turns into this, like, you must be doing this. And I think we're seeing that evolve right now into things that are actually like more inclusive advice and intersectional and queer friendly and, you know, not as heteronormative or cisnormative as it used to be. But it's the authoritative voice that is still kind of like making you be like, oh shit, I do have to be sex positive at all times, even if I am bloated and I'm really tired and like, oh, I'm not allowed to be. So I think there's still like this challenge of like meeting the expectations that the media demands or that, you know, we perceive to demand of each other.
I totally agree that just by nature of it being on like the cover of a glossy magazine with, you know, like a Hollywood A-lister or something like that, it really comes across as here are things that you must know or you need to be doing better. And of course, almost everything in all women's magazines, be it Oprah or Cosmo or Glamour, is about improving the self to make yourself more palatable and lovable and sellable and fuckable and all those kinds of things. And so much of what I love that you do on Reductress is, I don't know, a couple of the headlines that I kind of pulled out were 6 date ideas that are easier than admitting it's not working out, and 8 guys on Tinder that have been to Machu Picchu but never to therapy. And part of what I really love that you're highlighting here is there's this emotional labor element that I think media hasn't started picking up on yet. So they're starting to realize that maybe sex advice shouldn't be universal, and they're starting to realize that maybe there's different body types. But there's still kind of this element of you have to do all of this work in order to, like, earn a man.
Definitely. That has never left. And, I think what emotional labor was only even acknowledged in the past couple of years. So it's going to take another, like, 3 or 4 for, like, the mainstream to catch on it and then, like, find a way to make money off of it. Mm-hmm. But it's true. I mean, I don't think we like launched the site knowing that so much of our content would be devoted to that emotional labor element of just like how we relate to each other in relationships, but it's become a huge part. And that even extends to the content we do about women in the workplace and things like that. It kind of all ties together. I think the least we can hope to do is make women more aware of the specific things that they might be putting themselves through, believing that they have to, and that maybe, you know, it is actually absurd and they just needed to see it that way.
Yeah, highlighting the absurdity and using that as a way to give permission to maybe start like moving away from it. Like maybe you don't have to shave your armpits or maybe you don't have to worry about if that guy swiped right or not. And one of the things that I just would really love to know from you, since you're really in the thick of it, is I think Reductress and Onion are part of this movement, and like the Colbert Report of fake news as real news, and seeing that in some ways the fake news as real news is using humor to, as Reductress does, really punch up and kind of highlight the different ways that we're oppressed. But then there's also fake news coming out of like the quote unquote alt-right and a lot of their like pro-patriarchy, pro-racist bullshit. And I would love to know, just kind of as the Reductress has evolved, do you find that more people are actually using fake news to consume their news? Or do you think that people are still really treating it as entertainment for the most part?
I think there was a study back in like 2012 that a fair amount of people did use The Daily Show and Colbert Report as like their primary way to obtain news. And, you know, it makes sense. There's so much news, like we're just inundated with stuff on social media so much that sometimes skipping one step from the kind of source material and skipping to having a perspective on it, like good satire, really, like all it's really offering is just like a particular perspective on what's going on. And I think like a lot of people just by nature of not having a lot of time and also wanting to be entertained, like satire, it kind of makes sense why people are leaning toward that. Mm-hmm. As far as like actual fake news, like Breitbart level or like whatever they're doing in Russia, there's been sites like, fake news has always kind of been the enemy of satire, and they've always been like so-called satire sites and Onion knockoffs since, you know, the dawn of the internet. Mm-hmm. I think the real difference there is that fake news is like allowing people to engage in some kind of wish fulfillment when they read it. Like it engages with what they want to believe more than like what, you know, than what might actually upset them. Like, we hope that with good satire that we're at least like challenging people's perspectives or like, you know, pressing for them to see beyond what they're just taking for granted. But I think, you know, fake news is just all about wish fulfillment, and that's why we've seen it used on the right so much. And unfortunately now, like, the left with some unreliable news sources coming out there just simply to, you know, make money off of clicks.
When your whole team is really working together, do you have this sense of responsibility around making sure that you're constantly, like, challenging the status quo in a way that allows people to kind of move past some of their assumptions? Like, do you have this feeling of responsibility of maybe we can shift the dialogue a little bit with what we're doing?
Yeah. And but with that comes a lot of challenges, right? Because we're the premise of Reductress is that we're a satirical women's magazine. So think of all the problems that are baked into the genre, right? It's heteronormative, it's cisnormative, it talks down on women. So we're always at risk of perpetuating the things that we're against just by nature of the format. So that's a huge challenge. And then there's also, like, how do you speak about trans issues through satire that can't be misread? And how do you say something so clearly? How do you say something clearly enough that, you know, a wide swath of people can understand it as it's intended? And that's where it gets challenging. Like, it's fairly easy, and like we've been successful with doing the type of material that is like relatable to a lot of the majority of women, you know, the majority of women 18 to 35 who are like internet literate, and then some men. But I mean, it's very hard to talk about, I don't want to say niche, but just like really like talk about serious issues on the margins without sometimes misconstruing a complicated issue to be consumed by the masses who don't maybe share the language that we do within the office.
I love that so much. And I agree completely. You know, it's a powerful thing to recognize. And I think that you really beautifully tiptoed into some very sensitive topics when you did the homepage takeover around like rape culture and sexual assault and sexual harassment. And I thought that was one of the most powerful things that I had seen of using satire and humor to actually kind of call out rape culture in a way that was very palatable, to be aware that when you start talking about people who are really struggling at like multiple intersections and multiple margins and lots of people that are kind of, you know, mainstream wouldn't have the understanding of that language. So the nuance would potentially be lost. Like, you know, I have hope that we can get to a point where we can have these more nuanced conversations, but I definitely don't think that we're there yet for the most part.
Yeah, same. And I mean, I'm fully committed to speaking about it in any forum that's possible, but I'm still very, very wary as an editor to do it via satire.
Yeah. Have you ever broken from the satire mold on Reductress because there was just an issue that you felt needed attention, and it needed attention in a way that satire just wasn't going to work? Or do you use other platforms for those conversations?
We usually use other platforms for those conversations, although you'll probably see a headline every now and then that could just read almost as real. Like, there are definitely plenty of headlines on the border that kind of slip through, but we definitely, I can't really say exactly where we set the bar because it does kind of depend, we take it on a case-by-case basis, but we're never going to just go fully outside of the voice of the site on the site. That's the one thing we have. We hold on to it so dearly.
So I was doing some research of like other interviews you've done and articles about Reductress. And one of the things that cracked me up was that you get requests from men to feature men. on the Reductress. Like, why don't you have an advice column for men? Or why don't you have men featured? And I think that's just such a hysterical thing. And I'd love to know, like, is that something that you continue to get? Or has that kind of abated as people started to really understand what Reductress was about? And do you actually respond to these guys? Or do you just kind of, like, move on because it's not worth your time?
Well, it kind of depends on how well we know them. you know, like, yeah, totally. You know, just, like, pitch, send it to the email. I mean, like, bless everyone's hearts. Like, every pitch still gets filtered through our interns and gets in a pitch doc, so I fortunately don't have to, like, personally say yes or no to anyone's face. But we, fortunately, those requests have petered out a little bit, at least in the past few months. But I think, you know, it's a lot. There's a lot of well-meaning men who just think that, you know, they're inserting themselves in a conversation is valuable and important. And, like, honestly, I wish I had that level of confidence. If I was born that way, oh, I'd be running the world by now.
Right? One of my favorite headlines that I've ever seen on Reductress was actually a one that just came out a couple of days ago, and it just, like, perfectly encapsulated, I think, what you're talking about, and it's the 5 feminist men who will give you a hug whether you want one or not.
Yeah.
Kind of this, you know, I think that there's so many, like, cis men out there who are starting to kind of be aware of their privilege, and they're just aware enough of, like, patriarchy and oppression and feminism that they kind of label themselves feminists. And I definitely think there's a lot of men out there who are very powerfully using their privilege to challenge the status quo. But then we kind of get these, like, well-meaning guys who still don't quite get, like, taking up personal space and emotional labor, and but they know all the feminist terms. And so that headline alone just, like, I feel like you run into these guys a lot too in, like, kinky spaces, mm-hmm. where everyone's been through, like, the consent discussion and you shouldn't touch anyone without having a conversation about how somebody wants to be touched. But, you know, because they're feministy and they're, like, non-threatening, they'll just, like, hug you anyway because they know it's okay. And it's just kind of this, like, mild low-level frustration of just, like, oh, you still don't get it.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it, like, maybe it just, like, lends itself to, like, the people who are just more likely to be so vocal about their personal politics are also going to be, like, the most, like, outgoing and vocal in weird ways, in other ways, too. But, because there's plenty of great male feminists who don't even, like, need to talk about it all the time. Mm-hmm. Bless their hearts.
Bless their hearts.
Yeah, I like them. I'm a big fan.
So, I'm wondering, now that we're going to be moving under I hate even saying this, Trump presidency, do you see the content that you're posting on Reductress shifting or having, like, a new section that's dedicated just to kind of his presidency and his politics and what the world is going to look like under his rule for the next couple of years? Or are you really going to try and stick to more of the women's magazines and the women's issues, and if something comes up around him, then it kind of folded in?
I mean, a Trump presidency is a woman's issue, so yes. We've already begun. I mean, we probably, with just the exception of this week, like, we've been running pieces every day about Trump and Trump adjacent stuff, and
yes.
We'll probably continue to. Is there going to be a whole politics vertical? Probably not, but maybe. Who knows? Yeah, I think it's just going to be a continual thing. And, you know, we, Beth and I had to fly to LA the day of the election, and we had to go for work, and neither of us wanted to leave home for a week. But, you know, we both kind of steeled ourselves and realized, like, if ever there was a reason to do our jobs, this is the time. So,
yeah,
yeah, you know, this is part of our job now. We were kind of hoping we'd just be celebrating the fun quirks of having our first female president, but you know, this is the plate of shit we've been given.
Right.
So we're gonna make a shit sandwich.
I really think that you are gonna have endless additional material now.
In such a more frustrating, sad way, but this is just going to kind of write itself at this point for people who do comedy and satire, as SNL is showing us. But
yeah, I mean, yeah, there's definitely a level of it that writes itself. Like, it's like just everything about him is just like a walking joke, but there's the more I'm really looking forward to the comedians who are really willing to go there and talk about all of this more like insidious stuff that's happening, because it's pretty bad. And I don't know. I think some really incredible art is, if that's the only upside from this, there's going to be some incredible art that comes out of this presidency.
I totally agree. And I expect some fantastic Reductress headlines.
Me too.
Over the years, you've covered so many different aspects of women's lives and women's media and feminism. And I'm wondering, has there ever been anything that you published where afterwards you were kind of like, maybe that was a tad too far, or maybe we didn't like massage that one enough?
Not that I can think of. There are usually a few, like, mostly what happens is they get misconstrued. Maybe not necessarily that, like, people think they're real, but that, like, the intention in the headline is genuine, mm-hmm. when it's really, like, supposed to be undermining whatever is stated in the headline. And sometimes I feel a little bad when people are kind of genuinely hurt by that. Mm-hmm. Like, if it is something that's, like, a heteronormative, cisnormative headline. But I do find that we have a really good comment section on our Facebook page, and I do find that our readers do tend to self-regulate and kind of, like, discuss a lot of stuff pretty respectfully. So that helps. But, yeah, there's probably a few in the back that I felt kind of bad about.
That's one of the things that I found so fascinating is, you know, kind of the typical experience, I think, for women in social media and people who write about women or kind of write about feminism is this onslaught of trolls and cruelty and just hatred and disgust. And I was so pleasantly surprised to be reading through the comments of so many of your Facebook posts and seeing that people were genuinely just expressing their feelings about the post or laughing and tagging others. And there were some back and forth comments and one or two people kind of getting a little butthurt that their joke didn't land. But, you know, there overall seems to be kind of this lack of the typical internet cruelty. I find that so fascinating. And like, do you think that's just luck, or do you think it's because the people who read you tend to kind of be in on the joke for the most part, or how did you make that happen? Because I'm so, like, delighted by it.
I don't know. I mean, my only theory is that we're just not big enough yet to attract more trolls. that's about it. But it does seem like just the majority of people have their heart and minds in the right place, so it tends to, like, self-regulate the tone of the comments. But, yeah, I mean, there's still some trolls that find us. I mean, I think, the thing that I always notice in my, like, Reductress subtweet feed is there's just, like, always some man that's, like, responding to a Reductress post as if Reductress is just a stupid woman. Like, just talking down to a woman, like, fucking idiot. And it's just such a bizarre exercise because it's, like, you're talking to a wall. Like, you're just talking to, a Twitter bot, essentially. And that just never ceases to amaze me. But I think Twitter is still definitely, like, the wild, wild west of like, where the worst trolls tend to troll us. Mm-hmm.
As I was looking through your comments, one of the things that kind of cracked me up is you have a new post that came out called How to Impress Your Boyfriend's Mother When His Cum Is Still Inside You. Mm-hmm. And the responses are for the most part, a lot of like, oh my God, that's so gross. And oh my God, I'm so disgusted. I can't get that image out of my mind. And people pulling like little quotes about like keeping your legs together so his jizz doesn't slide out and all this kind of stuff in the comments. And it's really funny seeing, and several people said, wow, you went all in on that one, Reductress. And I wonder, like, do you feel proud when you get that kind of a reaction?
I may not, I don't know. I'm surprisingly prude when it comes to like putting out content like that. Like, I don't think anything in my actual life, like I'm not a prude in real life, but I think it comes down to when I'm like, here's the site, Mom. And like the most popular articles are just like dick, cum, butt, cum, jizz. And I'm just like, that's what I've been working so hard on all this time that I just get weird about that. So am I proud? Yes, but with some weird reservations, I guess.
There should be like a tag, like not for grandma.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think just like over and over and over again, the calling out of the ridiculousness around like the ideal sex moves and the top 10 sex, you know, seduction techniques and all that kind of stuff. It makes my sex educator heart feel so happy that people are getting it. And I wonder, I think that more and more people are becoming aware that kind of these like Bible style approaches to dating and seduction and sex aren't really the way that it works. You know, like this, they've been misleading us for years. And so there's more nuance, but I wonder, what are some of the softer, more subtle, less obvious kind of corrosive messages that you see in media aimed at women that you've been trying to really kind of bubble up through Reductress that maybe fewer people really realize is a problem?
It's the tone of fear and stoking insecurity. You'll see it a lot in just the way that headlines are tweaked. This is kind of a fun thing to do. If you ever like look at the actual link to whatever you're reading, and you can sometimes see the original headline before it's been updated to be more like intense to stoke fear or insecurity, or be like, or are you a terrible woman or something like that? Because it actually does get more clicks. And I think that has probably always been an issue with print magazines, but just got ramped up so much in the internet age when everything is just getting clicks that I feel like that just triggers our nervous system just like in little bits throughout the day every time we read it. And like maybe it's never like, oh God, this is like making me suffer, but like I think it just is like a slow drain on our self-worth if we are just like constantly asking ourselves like, wait, am I doing it wrong? Am I a terrible person? Am I really going to die if I don't do this? So yeah, it's really like the tone that gets me.
Yeah, I actually wrote a little bit of a rant a couple of days ago because I saw this short little article in The Guardian that had a title that of course got my attention, saying like a new study has found that women prefer penises that are slightly larger than average for one night hookups. And so of course I had to go read it, and then I found the study, and I actually read the study, and like what made me so angry was this was a study of like 75 cis heterosexual affluent white women in Northern California, and they were handed 3D printed cylinders of varying sizes that in no way resembled a penis, and then asked to like recall the penis size of a recent lover, and then if they had to pick one of the cylinders for a one night stand, which one would they pick? And they happened to pick one that was like a half an inch longer than like the standard male penis. And so now it was this like big headline that women prefer bigger dicks when it's one night stands and smaller dicks when it's ongoing relationships. And that kind of twisting of science, I think, is also so frustrating and dangerous because most people don't have the time to go read the study of like how many people participated and what were their demographics and what were the actual findings. And, you know, somebody's taking a one paragraph abstract and now it's getting picked up by all these news sources as like fact.
Sure. I mean, I see that happening all the time with janky studies. It even like happens on the flip side where it's like, drinking a glass of wine a day will make you a better fuck and you'll live till 100. And it's just like, that's also not true, but it's clearly like something you want to believe. So like you read the damn article, and I'm sure that that article about penis size just like horrified a bunch of like cishet men.
Yep.
just enough to click on it and then be like, oh wait, never mind. Yeah, it's so terrible.
It's really frustrating. And you know what's so interesting is I'd say that of the thousands of emails I've gotten in on this podcast, about 50% are, you know, if I'm kind of categorizing it in very broad strokes, it's like 50% are women, 50% are men. And I get a lot of emails from like trans and non-binary and all kinds of those folks. But, you know, when I really boil it down to kind of like the big categories, it's about half and half. And so many of the men that I get emails from are feeling a great deal of shame about their bodies, shame about either their libido, their penis size, how long they can stay hard, feeling like they can't ever be a real man, that no woman will ever love them. And so they are like socially isolating themselves. And men who feel like they must be terrible in bed because their partners aren't orgasming. And, you know, as I've done this over the years, it's really, I think we all know that like patriarchy hurts everybody. It's just in different ways. And, you know, I know bell hooks said that the first victim of patriarchy is men, but I think one of the like really powerful things about reading Reductress, not only for women, but for men, is also seeing like so many of these headlines that are manipulating women are also manipulating the way that women treat men, that kind of uphold this toxic masculinity, but then also these expectations that we put on men about what a real woman wants or what real men are like. And it's just kind of like this big toxic soup. I'm wondering, like, do you get responses from men about finding either relief or permission through the satire work that you're doing?
I haven't gotten a lot of relief emails. It's more like a curiosity. Like they're learning just a little bit about like what women experience. So usually it's like the typical well-meaning guy who's like, really, that happens to you? Whether it's like something about sex or something in the workplace or, mm-hmm. or elsewhere. So we get more of that, but I don't know if we've done a lot of, I don't know. I mean, I guess if it's like stoking any feelings in guys, they're certainly not talking about it to me. I wish they would. I wish guys would speak up more, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
They're just so hard and tough.
I know. I agree. That's one of the prices that we pay, right? With like hypermasculinity and patriarchy is that, you know, cis men feel like they don't have permission to feel awkward or to not be sure of what they want or to be unsure of seduction techniques. You know, it's kind of like you have to know all the things and be the expert and take up all the space, which then of course we see playing out when men ask to be featured on Reductress. But you know, it's kind of two sides of the same coin of just this toxicity that's kind of like harming all of us in different ways.
Yeah.
So I know that you did that big homepage takeover with all of the rape culture stuff that was like, I can't tell you, I saw probably 36 at least of my friends on Facebook around that time just posting screenshots of like, everyone has to go check out Reductress right now. and loving that. And I think like what I just really love to know, I have a couple of questions around that, but the first is like, how did you find your way of navigating talking about rape and sexual assault and rape culture in a way that was still within this kind of humorous punching up satire that you use on the magazine? I mean, it feels like a very dangerous line to tread.
Yeah. I don't think it could have happened in the way that it did if what had happened in the comedy community didn't happen and just everyone in the office's collective experience of rape culture. It was really coming from just a deep, sad, and genuine place of everyone who contributed and wrote for that homepage takeover. But what had happened in the comedy community was a man had been officially kicked out of Upright Citizens Brigade because he had raped at least two women and assaulted many more. And that was less of the story, and the story was more of the backlash and the conversations happening around it. The victim blaming, the, like, questioning women's claims, defending the rapist, or even just making bad jokes about the rapist. We were just seeing, like, every aspect of rape culture play out on social media, in podcast, radio, just, like, everything. We were just seeing all of it. Mm-hmm. And so when we had put out an ask for pitches around the subject, you know, we got hundreds of pitches in just minutes. And we realized, like, oh, there is no way there's just one way to talk about what's going on. There's at least 16 different individual topics to address here. And I think by keeping it specific rather than keeping in each individual piece as specific as possible and honed in on one aspect of rape culture, mm-hmm. we kind of avoided just merely saying rape is bad or be like, ha, dumb, you know, making fun of victims of rape or something like that. So we were just really kind of thinking of it like a cohesive piece, like maybe like a book with many chapters, mm-hmm. And really just tried to hit every important aspect of rape culture that we were seeing play out that week.
And what was the response? I mean, did that bring trolls out of the woodwork, or did you just get a lot of people who were really grateful that you were actually taking the time to take on this challenge?
Honestly, it was so all grateful, zero trolls, which
wow.
I was surprised by because I was a little scared the night before, being like, oh, is this going to be that thing?
Right.
Because, you know, like, the months following, it was just nonstop trolls around, like, just, you know, Trump supporters and all that stuff. But, mm-hmm. Yeah, there were not really any trolls, and just, like, a huge response, positive response, and a lot of thank yous, and a lot of, like, I never knew how to articulate things until I, you know, read this. And a lot of guys being like, is this really, like, is this how it is? So I think some really great discussions came out of it. And, you know, at the very least, we called it out for what it was.
Mm-hmm. Are there any topics that you haven't yet really either explored or you've only scratched the surface that you'd really love to feature on Reductress at some point in the near future?
I mean, I would love to dig into politics a bit more, but I have a feeling that it's not so much the topics, but the different mediums that we're really going to be exploring, just how the idea of Reductress can extend to, you know, video and uh-huh. and things like that, more than, like, other subjects necessarily.
I've been doing a lot of reading lately on the, like, power of intention, kind of the secret kind of approach to business and to women's lives of, you know, if you want it bad enough, then you can have your wildest dreams and riches. And so therefore, if you don't have those things, then it's because you don't want it bad enough. And kind of this, like, hyper individualism and this, like, hyper everything is your responsibility approach to, like, women's success and women in business. And I know there's some people doing some really awesome work kind of pushing back against that, but I'm wondering, is that something that you have taken on in Reductress yet, around kind of the way that women are expected to achieve success?
Yeah, we touched on that in the book a little bit, between the women at work section and our last section called Savor, Being a Savior, mm-hmm. Where it kind of touches on that, like, empowerment,
yeah.
The empowerment industrial complex, I guess, is what it's now becoming, mm-hmm. Like, just ways to, like, it's just amazing how well people have, like, capitalized on the idea of self-improvement and, like, constant reinvention and hoping and wanting. Like, how do you put a price on it? Well, you can. We mostly, you know, we tackle it from, again, just, like, what are the problem? What are the inherent contradictions in these things? Like,
yeah.
I mean, God, like, take Dove, for example, and the kind of, like, empowerment advertising and, and that it's like, oh, like, we're totally being body positive, but also we're selling you firming lotion to fix your problems. Like, and so there's just, like, always these, like, walking contradictions in, like, selling empowerment and kind of, like, selling these dreams. And we're just there to kind of point at them more than anything.
Have you had any companies come to you and ask for guidance on how to do better?
Yeah, you know, I was actually at an ad agency on Friday, and they were asking the same thing. I wish I had an answer. I think, I think that's really what I'm going to spend a year thinking about, because it's really, obviously it's easy to see the problems in what we do, but it's really hard to imagine what an ideal landscape is, because there's so many, even just among feminists, intersectional feminists, or anyone who cares about social justice, you'll get a million different ideas of what that should look like. Right down to the idea that, you know, that consumerism and capitalism itself should be abolished. So it kind of depends on, like, what shared worldview you're operating on, and that would inform my answer.
Yeah.
But I don't really have one big, like, solve other than staff an ad agency with people who don't look like you.
Yeah.
And that, like, look like the broadest swath of America that you can find, and avoid tokenism and strive for true diversity. And I think that's probably our best bet to operate within a capitalist structure. As for throwing it all out the window, then beats me. Gonna have to ask a cultural theorist on that.
Well, I think one of the really powerful things about what you do, and you've been doing it now for so many years, is you've had this unique opportunity to really kind of look under the covers or look behind the curtain of the ways that women specifically are told to love, are told to experience sex, are told to shape their bodies, are told to love their bodies no matter what they look like, and then all the products that get sold. And I'm wondering, like, as you've done this work, have you found that it's influenced your personal relationships and the way that you experience your body or the way that you experience sex, like, on an individual level?
I think being the most gay person in the office, I think I, like, kind of avoided a lot of the things that a lot of my coworkers struggle with. I mean, right down to, like, I'll just have talks with my straight friends and still in 2016 hear that, like, their boyfriend doesn't go down on them and, like, that they feel, like, uncomfortable about their vagina and what it looks like and what it smells like. And, like, that, I don't even remember the last time I've thought about stuff like that. Like, I know it's a thing, but I thought that, like, guys, when we're in our 30s, we're supposed to stop caring about that. But, yeah, I mean, I think I've just been maybe lucky enough to avoid most of that to begin with.
Yeah.
Not all of it, but most of it.
Yeah. Well, one, that's awesome. And two, like, yay for queer community.
Right.
And having space where you get to actually, like, explore a lot of those things and overturn them and then be surrounded by people who are like, oh, yay, you decided to stop shaving. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Or, you know, like, who gives a fuck what you do with your body? It's your body. You know, it's so difficult to find spaces where that's truly celebrated. And so, like, I love that you've been insulated from that because more of us need to be. What is kind of the number one thing that you want people to take away when they come to Reductress and they kind of start tiptoeing into the content that you're putting out and getting a feel for kind of what your tone and your voice is. Like, what are you hoping that, like, for all the listeners out there who haven't been to Reductress, I hope that they go check it out and kind of find some of their favorite headlines, because I'd love for them to share them with me. But, like, what are you hoping that people walk away with?
Well, first priority, I want them to laugh. That really, like, does come above everything. Like, we are making comedy. We are making satire. But secondly, I want them to at least come away acknowledging maybe some small thing that they may have taken for granted, that they can be like, oh, yeah, that. Whether it's something that happens to them or something that they do themselves. 'Cause, again, we do have a lot of fun... pointing out the foibles of white feminism that, like, we ourselves are totally guilty of. And we really try hard to make content that's not always just pointing at the big, bad white man all the time, and trying to find the nuance in what's really happening in the world around us so that we can read an article and maybe not just, like, point and laugh at the other, even if it is punching up, even if that other is like a CEO of ExxonMobil, but actually be able to kind of look within ourselves and maybe see things that we might not be doing that are so great, or that the people around us might be doing.
I love that. I know that a lot of the pieces that I've seen on social media that friends of mine have shared from your site have stimulated some really interesting conversations, and some of them have been fantastic and fascinating and, like, deepening the conversation, and others have brought out a lot of people who kind of do that knee-jerk defensiveness, like, hey, this isn't fair, you're picking on me and my life wasn't easy, you know, even though I'm like a white dude. But I love that there's just conversations happening, and I want more of that. More conversations, more finding ways to actually, like, engage with each other instead of just this constant, like, I'm not going to talk to anybody that's not like me, and, like, I don't care about anything outside my bubble.
Definitely.
Yeah. So there's one last thing I want to ask you about before we wrap up, and this can be a really hot button topic for a lot of different reasons, and I am definitely not the most educated on kind of the comedy world, so I'm kind of blindly asking this question a little bit, but I've seen so many articles, like, on The Establishment and The Body Is Not an Apology, really calling out Amy Schumer as being very problematic with her white feminism and the way she talks about sex and her body and other people's bodies. And I'm wondering, like, from your perspective as someone who is very media literate and who has a great deal of experience in comedy, and you've been in the comedy community, and what you put out there is all about being funny, have you on Reductress either taken on a perspective around kind of Amy Schumer's work, or do you have any thoughts about that? Because I'm really curious.
Well, we do have one piece on Amy Schumer called Amy Schumer, Amy Schumer, Amy Schumer, Amy Schumer. And it's about 1,000 words just being like, Amy Schumer, Amy Schumer, Amy Schumer. Amy Schumer, icon, Amy Schumer. And, like, I mean, I think that's the official Reductress stand on what Amy Schumer has done right and wrong in her career. Okay, so separate from how I personally feel about what Amy Schumer has done, I think that it's important to acknowledge the media cycle that has cycled around her. She didn't walk into stand-up saying, I'm a feminist. Mm-hmm. And boy, what she said early in her career is not very feminist. But she started making some content on her show that could be read as feminist. And then she didn't call herself a feminist. The media, you know, anointed her with the capital F feminist title. And then the moment that she did something not feminist, they, you know, she was lambasted for it. So I guess what I'm saying is, like, there are a lot of people that we hold in very high regard that are not necessarily out there having even branded themselves as feminists that we're then criticizing based on feminist standards. I personally never held her to that standard to begin with. I think she was never that, and I don't think that she has the... Maybe she does now, because, I mean, hell, I don't know her, but I don't think that she ever really had, like, the language to talk about the things that, you know, are important to the discussion of feminism. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if I can fully blame her. I think at this point, that she's now this big and has had this much time to reflect on it, that she does have a degree of responsibility to practice what she preaches, if she does choose to continue preaching. Yeah, you know, I don't give her as much shit as a lot of other people do, because I just don't think that she was really a feminist in the way that you and I would understand it any more than anyone else.
Yeah, I think we saw that happen too with, like, the porn star James Dean.
Mm.
You know, of he was labeled a feminist and realized that was an opportunity for growing his audience, and so then he took on that label, but at no point was there anything happening that was particularly feminist, that was really kind of challenging the status quo. And so I felt so much like hurt and anger and betrayal when all the rape allegations came out around him, and just kind of like this fallen icon of feminism. And it just made me really feel like we need to be a lot more careful with who we're labeling as kind of our feminist icons.
Yeah, exactly. Because, I mean, like, I didn't follow all of James Dean's porn, but as far as I know, like, the best thing he did was make porn that didn't suck.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, beyond that, I don't really know how he was, like, serving the community. So, yeah, we propped him up, and then we found out that he wasn't what we thought.
Right.
And it's very disappointing. And I think, you know, even Reductress... We didn't launch Reductress being like, this is going to be a feminist website. What made it feminist was the fact that everybody in this room is a feminist. And while we're full-time comedians and performing and writing, our feminism informs everything we do. So the content, by nature of that, is going to be feminist. But, like, we never, like, stuck our noses out and said, we are a feminist satire site. That label was given to us, and I wholeheartedly accept it and can bear that responsibility. But I think, you know, a few good years of queer theory and you know, all that, you know, I have some degree of ability to, like, back up that claim. But not everyone who gets propped up can.
Yeah. Yeah, and I also see... I think some of the difference that I see too around, like, the Amy Schumers and the James Deans of the world and other people like Reductress that get labeled feminism is for people who are willing to take on that responsibility, I see a willingness to be wrong and to apologize for that and then to grow from it.
Yes.
In a really genuine way of, wow, I didn't realize that we were whitewashing this, or I didn't realize that was an ableist term. And then we move on and we don't do it anymore. Versus, I think, when it becomes part of a brand that then becomes part of merchandising and becomes part of why you're popular, when the shit hits the fan and something really goes wrong, there's a lack of apology, or the apology isn't really heartfelt because they weren't really in it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And so then there's very little growth, or the growth happens kind of too little, too late.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah.
And yeah, you know, nothing has made me realize my own blind spots more than creating content. Mm-hmm. It really helps you learn, and you have to come at it with a degree of humility, because when you've got a big workload, it's easy to kind of let your blind spots really... get blinder, because you're just trying to burn through stuff. And I really appreciate when people are, you know, do point out stuff that, you know, might be wrong, whether it's just like who we represent in photos or anything like that. Like, you know, we're all coming at it with a degree of humility and are definitely willing to listen.
Yeah. And wouldn't it be amazing if all of us were willing to do that, even on the smallest scale of just in our personal lives? Like,
right?
If the people around us are saying, hey, I'm having this problem, if we would, instead of saying, wow, I don't see that, thank you for sharing that with me. I think we would have such, I don't know, there would be so much more growth and connection happening instead of kind of this like, well, it's not a problem for me, so good luck.
Totally. We all just need to like read our anger and like stop for a minute and be like, wait, why am I angry? Is it because I'm like afraid of being wrong or like losing this weird little seat of power I have in this discussion? And it's just like, if we just take 1 minute of every day that like we get kind of backed into a corner, we'd all be just a better society.
Yeah. And we would have, I think, deeper connections and deeper conversations and more opportunities for letting go of so many of the things that feel shitty. But you know, when we get defensive and we kind of want to stay in our little places of power, as you said, you know, what we're also doing is holding ourselves in those same places where we're feeling shame and uncertainty, and we can't be vulnerable around it.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah. Well, Sarah, I would love for you to share with everybody who's listening how they can stay in touch with you and find Reductress so they can go check out all the amazing work that you're doing and also support you by checking out the book and your podcast and all that good stuff. So where can they find you?
You can find Reductress at Reductress.com, at Reductress on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. You can find our book, How to Win at Feminism, The Definitive Guide to Having It All and Then Some, on Amazon or in any old bookstore you want to go into. Our podcast, Mouth Time, is available where podcasts are found. And you can find me on Twitter at your Papalardo.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining me and having this really rich conversation all about comedy and feminism. And this just made my day. So I really appreciate you carving an hour out.
No problem. It's great talking to you.
Great. Thank you. You too. To all of our listeners, thank you so much for tuning in. Be sure to check out Reductress. I will have all of the links on sexgetsreal.com for this episode. And I will be talking to you next week. Bye.